From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. We're continuing to follow the situation in Ukraine, but today Rebecca Cruz and I talk about some of the more under-the-radar protests in Thailand and Venezuela.
It looks like violence on both sides. The government is responsible, the protesters are responsible. There are still a lot of pro-government people in Venezuela.
And later, more in our series on identity and literature with Andrew Lamb.
From reading other people's experiences, you can begin to bridge what you didn't think was bridgeable.
Chris Lee.
Returning creates a different kind of story.
And Ananda Devi.
I can't say it's my mother tongue, but it's the tongue of my heart because it's the language in which I write.
But the news is first. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot. Rebecca Cruz, since you and Paul Good focused on Ukraine a couple of weeks ago, we've seen a significant change in the country. The president fled. Russian troops then pretty much immediately showed up in Crimea. We've had, most recently this week, the Crimean parliament voting to secede and become part of Russia, which will require a referendum on secession. The United States has responded. The European Union responded. Everybody's trying to get everybody on the same page here. It's clearly escalating and, I don't know, spiraling out of control in some ways. But are we headed to another cold or hot war?
I hope neither, to be honest with you. I think that there are a lot in the media that are trying to portray this as a cold war, and there certainly are facets of that, the Russians, the United States, Ukraine stuck in the middle. And perhaps some of this cold war rhetoric came about during the Olympics, as we saw a lot of references back to the 1980s Miracle on Ice, and even a couple of news channels were reporting that the Soviet Union, as opposed to Russia, 20 years after the end of the Cold War. So this kind of discourse has certainly been in the air, and we certainly have seen some very strange activity by the Russians. Didn't expect to see troops on the ground, but they are there.
Well, certainly back in November sometime, we were talking on this program when those protests started up about how this was reminiscent of kind of East versus West. And we start to see some of that. NATO starting to move. They're engaging in exercises in Poland and the Baltic countries of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. And the United States actually getting behind Ukraine on this, $1 billion of loan guarantees. Now, Ukraine, it's the one thing that's actually brought our House of Representatives together, a really significant bipartisan vote in support of Ukraine. So it would indicate perhaps that the United States is saying, now, wait a minute, Russia, hands off of this new fledgling government.
Absolutely. I think that is the message that they're trying to send. And of course, it was the economic troubles that kind of started this at the beginning. There was some serious unemployment issues, other economic issues. Many in Ukraine were trying to look towards the European Union. Russia was offering a bailout. So the economic concerns remain, and it looks like the United States is going to help out.
Well, it doesn't seem to be coming to an end anytime soon. But it certainly isn't the only place in the world where we see protest and violence and attempts to try and ouster governments. Let's look at Thailand. Nobody's really talking about Thailand, but we've had protests going on in Thailand for many months and recent escalation and violence there to remove the prime minister and her government. It's a very interesting story of kind of regional and class division in Thailand. The north and the northeast are primarily the rural parts of Thailand versus the more urban south where Bangkok is. There are serious clashes here. People accusing this prime minister of being a puppet for her brother, who was the former prime minister, who was ousted and exiled and is a billionaire. I mean, this all seems really kind of sketchy, but nonetheless, violence and protests and attempts to try and remove another government by force.
Yeah, in some ways, it does feel a little bit like a soap opera that the relations that are going on here, as you mentioned, the brother was ousted in a coup some years back, and now the sister, this started when she put forward an amnesty bill that would allow him to come back. So that's how it started. Some of that was taken away, but once these protests start, as we saw in Ukraine, the thing that actually starts the protest isn't always what continues continues them moving forward. So a lot of new allegations against her government. And in fact, the protests have scaled back somewhat. They have now moved to one area of the city, a square in the city. And it's kind of humorous here, too, because the opposition in the square, they have a very lovely tent city that they've built up. There's tea stalls, there's TV, all sorts of amenities, showers even. So they're protesting, but they're protesting in style. But what's interesting here is that it looks like the protests may not actually lead to an ouster of government, but the courts may take over and may be able to bring the prime minister to what many would consider justice. There's a number of corruption charges against her, and she will have to go and face the court system. So that could be a significant change.
Well, it clearly seems like both sides are digging in their heels. There was an attempt to call for early elections, and that failed because nobody could trust each other that the elections were going to be fair. So far, the royal family in Thailand and the military have kind of stayed out of this, interestingly. So this is a political battle that's going on. But yet, let's go to another region very quickly and end here with Venezuela. We also see this going on in Venezuela, more and more violence going on there at the anniversary of Hugo Chavez's passing away.
Yes, we just marked the year-long anniversary. Lots of internal conflict going on there. Violence, it looks like violence on both sides. The government is responsible. The protesters are responsible. On the one hand, we have the opposition to Maduro, the current leader who took over from Chavez, saying that these are the opposition is saying that these are motorcycle gangs and other people causing the violence. And Maduro is saying that these are fascists. So a lot of internal struggling. We are in the West getting a lot of pictures of people in the streets and the violence. There are still a lot of pro-government people in Venezuela. So it's not nearly as clean cut as perhaps it's being presented.
Well, clearly enough unrest to go around, I'm afraid. Something we'll continue to watch and report about. Thank you so much, Rebecca, for your analysis.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you might have about Ukraine, Thailand, or Venezuela. We're on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Gorelot and at Cruz226. Next, we'll continue our series about identity and international literature with authors from Vietnam, South Korea, and Mauritius. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot. Andrew Lam grew up in South Vietnam, and his family left the country in 1975 during the fall of Saigon. His most recent book, Birds of Paradise Lost, collects short stories about Vietnamese trying to build new lives in Northern California. Chris Lee was born in Seoul, and her debut collection tells stories of hardship of Koreans after World War II in both their homeland and the United States. Ananda Devi was born on the tiny Indian Ocean island of Mauritius, and her work reflects the diversity of the country's multicultural society. Andrew Lam, Chris Lee, Ananda Devi, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Andrew, let me start with you. Your background is Vietnamese, you're Vietnamese-American, and you've written essays about Vietnamese identity in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about how one can really reflect their culture and identity through the written word.
It's from reading. I grew up confused mostly because I spoke English better than Vietnamese. And yet when I go home, it is a refugee Vietnamese language culture. And when I'm in school, it is an American culture. In my household, my name is Yung. In school, my name is Andrew. I go as if from one country to another within the same day. And I had always found that really strange. Yet only my Andrew persona seems to be the only one survive in the English in the daytime. And writing and reading was a way to begin to understand how I can marry this two night and day kind of dichotomy. And I found that, in fact, it was language. It was from reading other people's experiences that you can begin to bridge, you know, what you didn't think was bridgeable, because I had a hard time explaining just talking to my friends at school what I was like at home or my culture back in Vietnam. But when you started writing and reading other texts that had had that similar experiences, you begin to realize it's possible through the use of the written language to express oneself and to somehow make the two polar world somehow bridge and connect.
So, Andrew Thunder, that's very interesting. Chris, you are of South Korean descent. So how does what Andrew is talking about in terms of his confusion and living these two different lives at one time and how literature helped him kind of bridge that gap, does that resonate with you at all in your experience?
Certainly. The story is very familiar, and the way I experienced my childhood in America as well. Growing up in a very conservative Christian Korean family where my mother didn't speak any English at all. But I was one of a returning group of people who's gone back to their homeland, and I live in South Korea now and have spent more than half my life out of America at this point. And I found that returning comes with, you know, creates a different kind of story in the sense that the confusion is really no longer there, because both of them are, both these countries and both these worlds are mine, and yet they aren't. And, you know, you end up solidly somewhere in between the two. But I kind of embrace that in between. I think even the title of my book, I wasn't really thinking about that as who I was, but Drifting House, which is the title, was very much a place, I think, where we all inhabit, not just people of different cultures, but people who don't feel as if they belong to their society, or somehow feel as if their family perhaps is theirs and yet not theirs. I think we all have the experience of some kind of estrangement, and culture and race is one way to look at it, but there's so many other ways that we experience this phenomenon. So, you know, I think of myself as a kind of drifting house, and home is wherever you happen to be at that moment, and you make it yours.
I'm speaking with Southeast Asian authors Andrew Lam and Chris Lee about identity and literature. We'll hear from our third guest, Ananda Devi, after this short break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. I'm talking with authors Andrew Lam and Chris Lee about literature bridging the gap between their Asian and American identities. We're also joined by Mauritian author Ananda Devi. Ananda, I would like to bring you in on this discussion, although you're from Mauritius, right?
Yes.
But you write in two different languages, French and English. You've won many awards. You've written fiction, but you also engage in socio-anthropological studies. I mean, what you're hearing here from Chris and Andrew, how does this reflect what you experience and what you've studied in terms of the sociological, anthropological issues of identity and culture and how that transcends borders and is expressed through literature, but also, you know, as somebody who is growing up and coming from kind of a multicultural background and working in different languages, all three of you, you know, working in different languages. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I absolutely agree that coming from this multicultural background, at the same time, it opens up your ideas, your thoughts, your way of looking at the world, and at the same time makes identity and language a core component of who you are, and a core questioning, because all your life you are constantly questioning yourself about where your place is, if you have a place in society. And for example, today I find it very difficult to say what my mother tongue is, because the language that my mother used to speak to me when I was from birth onwards is a South Indian language. My great-grandparents emigrated from India to Mauritius. But as I was growing up in a multilingual society, I went to school and I had a completely westernized education. So French and English were the two main languages that I learned. So from the age of 5 onwards, I was only speaking French at home. So my parents started speaking French to me. as well, in a kind of sort of for integration purposes. But then I lost Telugu. So in a way, I have Creole, which is the lingua franca of Mauritius, but it's part of the story. I have French. I can't say it's my mother tongue, but it's the tongue of my heart because it's the language in which I write. I write very, very little in English. It's mostly the 15 books I've written are in French. And I have this emptiness where Telugu is, and my mother has since passed away, so in a way there will always be that void of where it is. So writing in a way fills it because you're constantly questioning yourself but also peopling yourself with others. You're filling that void, and I felt that finally literature has become my mother tongue, let's say. But at the same time, I've always felt that literature has books have two components. One is the form, the language, style, and one is the substance. And what I write about is very much fed by my social anthropological studies, coming from Mauritius, which is in the Indian Ocean and east of Africa, Madagascar. So I was growing up at the time of independence, the fight for independence. So all this history, this very torn apart history of the ancient history of slavery, of indentureship, plus the fight for independence and colonialism do feed into my work. So the two of them come together through those two components.
It's fascinating to hear what all of you are saying about, as Ananda was talking about, a void, or Chris was talking about an in-between, living kind of between cultures or being comfortable with that in-between world, and Andrew referring to kind of some confusion and just being in one place and then another and kind of going back and forth. These kind of multiple identities that all of you have developed as being, multicultural, then working in different languages and living in different places. But I'd like to relate that to this notion of literature and translation. I mean, those of us, of course, who largely read one language, which many U.S. citizens do, that we derive a tremendous benefit from being able to read the works that you're referring to in translation, the works that were produced first in Vietnamese or Korean or French, and then presented to us in translation, and vice versa. Those who were written by American authors or those English-speaking authors that then are translated into other languages. But is there something that can get lost in that translation in terms of these identities that you're talking about and the social and cultural messages that are really important and come across in native languages, that it's difficult to translate those and fully comprehend them? Or, is there just so far that we can go, but at least we get that far?
Well, I'm translating a book right now, and I've for Houghton Mifflin, and I've translated a lot of poetry as well. And when I see the world of translators around me in Korea, I think what does have more risk of getting lost, in some ways, you're going to lose something inevitably, but it's less often the sociological context or the world of the novel or the poem than it is the voice of the novel and the poem. And that has a lot to do with, just, is the translator a person who understands the sensitivity of the language, both languages, in Korean and in English, or in Farsi and in English? And that seems to be more important in some ways. There are some things that, if it seems as if the world is less accessible or harder for a reader outside of that culture to contextualize, I think within the world, at least, it's usually implied, and occasionally they're going to be using footnotes. But it's often actually the voice, particularly some books that are very difficult to translate with regional accents or a history that is almost inaccessible in some ways because it assumes greater knowledge. Those works are often not translated or have very difficult timing translated. And that's the real pity, that that the attempts aren't made because it's so difficult.
Does that sound like something you would,
sure,
would identify,
I mean,
with, Andrew, because of your talking about confusion? I mean, how do you translate that feeling of confusion?
It's very hard to translate unless you have lived in both places, and because the cultural references will be missed. On the other hand, I've read, I watch movies that are dubbed and having understood both languages, I get really frustrated when the translation is so bad that you feel like it's completely misunderstood. But there's a side story to all this, is that very few books actually get translated. And there's a ton of beautiful, wonderful materials that don't get read in the United States simply because they are deemed not commercial or sellable enough. And that's the real pity, is that we think that we are reading the world, but we are reading very little of the world. And I think that's the sad part of it. And being cosmopolitan, being someone who's multilingual, I feel so enriched and blessed to be able to read in other languages in which I can immerse in the full aspect of that culture, you know. And I think there are really things that are lost in translations.
Yeah, that's, I think, what's the bottom line, is what's really critical is being able to really immerse yourself fully into that other culture and another language, like you've been able to do, Ananda.
Yes, and I must say that translators who've translated my work or who I've worked with are usually people who are passionate about that work. So they will try everything to bring together both this content and the voice. And I think they do a fantastic work because they really put themselves into it. And poetry is the most difficult thing to translate. But very often poets translate poets, but even those who translate novels are very, very passionate about it. So it is a pity that there's not more work in translation being published in the States, because it's the next best thing from reading it, in the original language, is to read it in a translation, because even if something is lost, you're gaining much more. So, but unfortunately in America, it's as Andrew was saying, there's very, very little work in translation that's published and read, whereas in Europe it's the opposite, actually. There's a very, very large corpus of work in translation. So I think fiction brings a worldview that is, at the same time, it's a built-in and imaginary worldview, but there's a sort of a core of truth in it that you can't get through news items, 5-minute news items every day on the news. You see, the way to go into a place, go to the heart of the place, to me, is really through literature.
Well, all of you have inspired me so much. I'm ready to go pick up a book here now that we're done. Well, Ananda, Chris, and Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on Worldviews.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Andrew Lamb, Chris Lee, and Ananda Devi about identity and international literature. We have links to their work on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies and KGOU. Hillary Gibson prepared the research for this interview, Nick Aguilera wrote the web version of this conversation, and Brian Hardzinski produces the program. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.